If you talk a lot, first questions, is a talking meditation? No, but there is masking tape. How did you cope with your mother's death? Easy. It's only a mother. All the time I've known her, I knew she was going to die one day. So she finally did it. So she had Alzheimer's disease. So it was actually a nice release for her. I was very happy when I heard the news she died. Released from a prison. You want people to live a long life and suffer old age? You know what it's like when you get old. You know, your eyes go, you have to wear glasses. Your ears go, you have to wear hearing aids. Your hands start shaking and your legs are weak. You have to, you know, have a frame or a walking stick. When you get old, your body all starts to fall apart, except for one thing. The older you get, the stronger your mouth. Old people can really talk. That's why I don't need to retire. The older I get, the longer I can talk. But my mother, she had lived a good life. That's wonderful. I don't know why people are so upset when people die. There's this culture of grief which people have in the West these days. And you know, even people we don't know, when they die, people get sad. Oh, isn't it sad? Princess Diana died. What are you talking about? She wasn't my relation. Oh, it got even crazy. Those two people in Indonesia who got executed, people were grieving for them. It's a bit crazy, I think. People live, people die, and they have another chance afterwards. I asked one of the prisoners I know, which would you prefer, having a life sentence or being executed? He said, you know, some of the jails, you know, it's actually more compassionate. You know, they don't want to stay in a terrible jail like that for year after year after year after year until they die. Because if you get executed, then you get reborn again. You can have another chance. As soon as you're executed, you're free of jail. That's one way of looking at it. What do you reckon? There's so many different ways of looking at things. But when a person dies, why grieve? Especially if it's a really good person. I like telling this story, suppose. Suppose to raise funds for Newbury Buddhist Monastery, we had a raffle. And the first prize would... Sorry? You know what's coming next, probably. Yes. You've heard me before. The first prize was a holiday for two to LA. Flying. Not Qantas. Flying New Zealand Airlines, that's one of the best airlines in the world apparently. Flying Air New Zealand, first class for two. And staying in a 6-star resort in Los Angeles. And having dinner with a different movie star every evening of your choice. And having $1,000 US each for the two of you to spend anywhere you like in LA. And if you manage to win that prize, would you be happy? Would you be excited? Would you think, oh, only 2 weeks and then I go to LA first class all the way, $1,000 per day each to spend, meeting your favorite movie stars, Bruce Willis, he just looks like Ajahn Brahm. Angelina Jolie just looks like Cora. as a compliment. Thank you. I better not go further though. I'm going to get in big trouble. Fortunately, I'm leaving tomorrow, so I can say whatever I like today. Wouldn't you be excited? Wouldn't you start packing a couple of days before leaving? Wouldn't the night before you're about to go on this incredible holiday, you know, wouldn't you be sort of excited, hardly sleep that night? you'd be excited, you'd be looking forward to it. So, what's better? Going to LA, first class on Air New Zealand, six-star hotel, $1,000 to spend, or going to heaven? Which is better? Going to heaven is much better. So why is it when you win the lottery and they say you've only got 2 weeks to live? Why is it, you should say, yes, in 2 weeks I'll be going to a place better than LA. And you'd be saying, you'd be packing your bags 3 days before dying. You say, I can't wait, I'm dying tomorrow. This is just another way of looking at it, isn't it? So that's why I say then people grieve. If a good person dies, there should be a celebration. There should be balloons in the chapel. You should do a dance, a celebration. A woohoo, yes, mother has died. Hooray, she's gone to heaven. Wonderful, have a wonderful time. That's much better than grieving, getting crying. Yeah, if somebody's done bad stuff and they're going to hell or bad rebirth, then fair enough. A waste of a life. But if they lived a good life, death should be a celebration. Wonderful life. Well done. Instead of all this grief business. Now, because I go over to many funerals, and people of my generation are dying, and so sometimes the music they play, I recognize that music. And now I'm very proud of a few of my disciples that when they, before they die, they tell their partner what to play at their funeral. And a couple of times now, as they're walking out, at the very last song as we commit the coffin, is Life of Brian. Look on the bright side of life. That's a wonderful song to play at the end of a funeral. Those of you who know Life of Brian, Bright Side of Life. So in other words, they have a positive idea of their death. Not so this negative. Or like the TV star who died recently. You know, he was on, you know, you've been to the crematoriums. He was on the little conveyor belt and they pressed the button, he went, you know, behind the curtain. So everybody clapped, so he came out the curtain again to take another call. Then he went back again and again. Curtain calls. I don't remember what I wrote about, and the funerals are just so boring. They were just about to build a new crematorium in Fremantle, one of the big crematoriums in Perth. And I actually asked them for a new design for a crematorium. I don't know what the ones you've got here are. Is it you put it on the conveyor belt, it goes behind a curtain? Or is it they go down? That's terrible. Why don't you have it going up? Imagine that. Your old mother, she's in the box there. And then when the priest or the monk presses the button, it rises up into the air with all this beautiful heavenly music and dry ice and goes up through the top through a trapdoor in the ceiling. Now that is uplifting. That's like a metaphor. Your mother's going to heaven instead of just down into the ground, into hell. I thought, wouldn't that be a wonderful idea? Have crematoriums where the body goes up instead of sideways or down. But when I suggested that, one of my friends said, hang on a moment. Because that would be not truthful. Because some people, we know they're not going to go up. We've got to be honest about it. And so I had this other idea. Okay, we'll have three buttons. One to go up, one to go down, one to go horizontal. And to make life interesting, at the funeral service, we can have a vote. So that make it really important. You go to the funeral service, you have a vote which way they go. You know, up, down, or horizontal. Wouldn't that make it exciting when you go to funerals? Much more interesting. And the answer is down, when they go down. Anyway, that's my idea of funeral services, make them more interesting. In this competitive society, it's very hard to train our children how to be at peace, be kind and gentle. How can we teach our children good qualities while educate or train them for a good profession? Educate and train them for the very best profession. monks and nuns. Wouldn't you be proud if your child said, I want to be a monk? Would you? Honest? Because I remember telling Dr. Kesari Dhammananda, I mentioned him earlier, the most, this is Malaysians, I think it probably will be the same for Sri Lankans. They'll be very, very happy if their daughter decides to become, no, they'll be very happy when someone decides to become a monk or a nun. As long as it's not your son or daughter. So you're training, but even training your kids. You've seen how much meditation is done in schools these days? This is really taking over because it works. It makes your kids get higher grades in school and become socially more adaptable, more sort of cohesive with their friends. So people do this at school. And you're Buddhist, you've got the advantage. You can teach them these things at home. They can get even further ahead than their friends. So in a competitive society, when people are teaching meditation at these top schools, maybe your school can't afford it, but you can teach them at home. So you teach them how to meditate. Teach them how to have good social skills. As Daniel Goleman pointed out, emotional intelligence is the key to success, not intellectual intelligence. That was that. He's a Buddhist, Daniel Goleman. He noticed as a sociologist that all the people who get double first class honours in big universities, they don't make anything of their life. And so it's not a good indicator of success. Look at Einstein, dropped out. Steve Jobs, dropped out. Michael Dell, dropped out. All these people that never even finished university. So making your kids finish university, you are stopping them becoming billionaires. Well, maybe not, but it's emotional intelligence is what drives success, not an IQ. And in the schools, we measure IQ. We give success to people who pass exams, not people who have emotional intelligence. So have to balance the education which they get at school with the education at home or in the temple, where you learn a lot about emotional intelligence. That's why, you know, they get monks to go and teach these people. I find it difficult to be kind to my mind, as in the back of my mind I know I have too many defilements. I'm not a very helpful person. Does it mean I better not to practice meditation, telling myself a lie that I don't believe in myself? Yeah, focus on doing more merits. Any excuse. This is an excuse. No. If you're sick, that's when you've got to go to the hospital, see the doctor. You don't say, oh, I've got too much sickness, I might spread it to my doctor, I'm not going. If you're sick, you go to see the doctor. If you've got lots of defilements, that's where you have to come and meditate. If you don't have any defilements, then you don't need to be here, do you? So it's because you have defilements, that's why you need to meditate. Because you're sick, that's why you need to be kind and caring. And put people in a nice ward in hospital, look after them, care for them, give them nice food, and then they get better. So kindness is necessary if you have defilements. So if you have defilements, you need to be kind. You don't say, I mustn't practice meditation, I've got to do merits first. The best merit is meditation. So do meditation first, and merits come afterwards. Big merits. If you're disappointed after years of marriage, even though, who wrote this? This is, oh, I can recognize the If you're disappointed after years of marriage, even though after you put so much energy into that, once decided to break up and now separated, how do you handle the disappointment and pain memories? If you're already separated, you look at the past, you had many happy memories together, and you had many painful memories together. Why is it that after a separation, We always remember the bad memories. Look at the photograph. You're always taking photographs these days. I've been to many people's houses and I've seen the photographs on their walls. They have photograph of their marriage. I've never yet seen a photograph of people's divorce. Here's me at the lawyers. Here's me at the courthouse doing the settlements. You see people when they graduate from school or university, throwing their caps into the air, shouting, receiving these little pieces of paper from these people in penguin suits. And I never see any photographs of you doing exams. 11, 12 o'clock at night, finishing off the assignment. You don't have photographs of that. You have the happy memories. You have happy memories of you being on holiday, you know, over in, I don't know where you go on holiday, say in Bali, or holidays in sort of New York or London. Here's me in front of Buckingham Palace. I've never seen anyone. Here's a photograph of me going to work on a Monday morning in the traffic. Here's a photograph of me in the office toiling away. You have, I've never yet seen a photograph on people's walls in the house of when they're sick in hospital with all the tubes inside them. Here's me having my bypass operation. You never see that. You only see photographs of happy times. That's why we have those photographs, to remind us of the happy moments, to uplift us and give us joy. But there's another photograph album which is between your ears, especially of a marriage, and now you're keeping all the unpleasant photographs. I remember the time when he was unfaithful to me. I remember the time he came home drunk and he forgot to bring home the washing. I remember the time when he shouted at me. I remember the time just when he walked out of the house. I remember the time when he gave me plastic surgery, cutting up my credit cards. I remember, that's called plastic surgery in a marriage, cut up the credit cards. You remember all the unhappy memories. I remember the time he gave me the Valentine's Day of a pack of playing cards. Why is it that we always remember the unhappy memories after a marriage? Now that is ridiculous. If you have a photograph and it doesn't come out right, or it's not a nice one, you delete it. If it's one of those old photographs, you burn it, put it in the rubbish bin, and you keep the nice photographs. So of your marriage, all the unpleasant memories, delete, 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 shred, 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 and keep the happy ones. You had many happy times, you had maybe children. You know, here's me with my husband and my first kid. Keep the happy memories. Because marriage isn't all bad. You have so many, many happy memories, but sometimes it, you know, it passes its use-by date like anything else. Even milk has its use-by date. Marriage has a use-by date as well. Even Ajahn Brahm has its use-by date. But my jokes, they don't have any use-by date at all. I can keep repeating them again and again and again. So it does mean that you can remember the beautiful memories. That is what you should be doing. Yeah, two bad bricks in the wall, that's why you separated. But you have so many happy memories. Please keep the happy ones. They're there, and delete the unhappy ones. Do you have any retreats in Perth Monastery within this year? The, like, few days meditation program? Yes, we do. But it's very difficult to find a secret to come on one of my retreats. If your karma is good enough, you can find out the times for my retreats in Perth. And you can find out how to register for those retreats. But only if you have good karma. You have to make the effort. Hello, Ajahn Brahm. Hello, whoever this was. How do I deal with people who lie? Thank you. Hands up here, anyone who's never told a lie. Be honest, if you never told a lie. So each one of you have told lies. So the question is, how do I deal with all of you? husband would say, how do I deal with people who lie? Because they don't lie all the time. Just because a person tells a lie doesn't mean they're a liar. So, you trust them. I'd rather trust a person and be disappointed than not trust a person at all and always be afraid. So always trust a person. Give them the benefit of the doubt. And if they do tell a lie, maybe just you misunderstood them, or that they were just explaining themselves badly, or whatever. And then you don't have to worry. How can I stop feelings of resentment? Thank you. Look at it in a different way. Someone has cheated you, they've hurt you, they've done something wrong to you. Incredible, there's a wonderful opportunity for you to learn and grow. I was really resentful of mosquitoes in Thailand. I hated mosquitoes. Now, this was in the jungles, northeast Thailand, 40 years ago. Now those mosquitoes, they were born in a Buddhist country. It was 96% Buddhist or something in Thailand. They knew we couldn't kill them. And they took advantage. In Sri Lanka, there's many Christians. They don't know who's a Christian, who's a Buddhist, who's a Hindu or Muslim. And so when they land or so, they don't know they're going to get squatted or not. They don't know who's a Buddhist. But in Thailand, they're all Buddhist over there, so they know it's a safe meal. Especially if they see a brown robe. Brown robe, they all know. It's been, you know, evolution, you know, just over the years, and they got to know brown robe, safe meal. So they took advantage of me. More than that, in that part of the world, Western monks, not just Western monks, I went to one village and I was the first Westerner, the first white man they'd ever seen, forever in their history, in that village. And especially a monk as well. When I went on alms round, you know, like you put rice in the monk's bowls? You know, you're supposed to be looking in the bowl when you put rice in it. These people, they were looking at me. And the rice kept falling outside my bowl. I've never seen a white man before. The dogs were very happy. They really cleaned up that day. They were just all the dropped rice. So, this was the first time ever that those mosquitoes had Western food. You know, whenever you start off a new cuisine, it's always popular, it's fashionable. So I'm really sure those mosquitoes told all their friends, hey guys, Western food in this monastery. We got eaten to bits by those mosquitoes. And then he went to see Ajahn Chah. Can you get some mosquito repellent? We didn't have it. And we're really poor monasteries in those days. Mosquito repellent? No. Mosquito screens? No. Mosquito anything? No. He said, they're killing us. He said, they're not killing you. He said, from this day on, I want you to call those Ajahn Mosquito. Ajahn means teacher. They're going to teach you something. And you're going to learn from them. So I had to change resentment to respect. To learn so much from Ajahn Mosquito. So whoever you're resentful to, they're now your teacher. Ajahn X, partner. Ajahn boss at work. Tough lesson, but you learn so much from the difficulties of life, like I learned from the mosquitoes. Talking about that, what I learned from mosquitoes, because they were killing me when I was meditating, hundreds of them on your body at the same time, honestly. And then, actually maybe exaggeration, 60 or 70 was as much as I could count. And the only way was to meditate properly. I couldn't allow my mind to wander. If it did, it would just go to this, you know, really irritating number of mosquitoes all on you at one time. And you couldn't swat them. And I tried, like many people do, just shift them. Okay, off you go. All they do is just go and land somewhere else and put another drill hole in your skin. So the only thing, just let them bite you. You had no other choice. But then you meditated. And that's why I learned how to go really deep inside. So I couldn't feel the mosquitoes. You know, that's how you learn how to just to let go of the body. Because if I didn't let go of the body, it would be so irritating. So I just went inside and getting a nice meditation and couldn't feel the body anymore. And so the mosquitoes could, you know, go for broke. I didn't care, I couldn't feel my body. I mean, the interesting thing afterwards, I thought this was one of the powers of samadhi, because when I came out afterwards, you know, I didn't have so many bites. You know, you have these little bumps, little welts on your skin where the mosquito bites if you're a Westerner. And there's no bites there at all. I thought, wow, this is amazing. Somehow with meditation, I had a force field, I thought, and the mosquitoes couldn't penetrate it. That's what I thought. But many, many years later, I found out the reason why was that the mosquitoes, they're attracted to the carbon dioxide, which comes out of your pores. That's actually what they come towards. And the more you worry, the higher your metabolism, more carbon dioxide, the more they know you're there. And because I was getting so quiet and still in meditation, my metabolism was going way down, hardly breathing, hardly any carbon dioxide coming out. Because I was in meditation, I was becoming invisible to the mozzies. And that's why if there's any mozzies, if you get really irritated, you're actually telling them where you are. If you really relax and be peaceful, they can't find you. So that's one of the reasons. It wasn't anything psychic at all, it was just quite natural. My metabolism had gone down, they couldn't find me. So they went to bite the other monks. Okay. So they became ajahns. So feelings of resentment, whatever it is, that's a great teaching for you. So look at it in another way. I am 35 years on from, three and a half years on. I think people said I didn't need to do this one. They said I could pass this one question down. Is it possible to have more compassion for another than we've developed for ourselves? Of course it is, and it's wrong. What did the Buddha say? To have, may all beings be happy and well. Aren't you one of those beings? Don't you count as well? So may all beings be happy, which means includes you. You know that in a marriage, there's usually one partner is Hinayana, one partner is Mahayana. You know what I mean? Hinayana, you know, is the idea, Mahayana gave this idea, when you're just in it for your own enlightenment. Just selfish, it's in it for me. So the Hinayana partner in a marriage, one is all about me, what you can get out of that marriage. And the Mahayana is one who sacrifices everything for all other beings. So in a marriage, that's a man or the woman, they sacrifice everything for their partner. So that's what usually happens in a marriage, one selfish and one sacrifice. Both are wrong. That's nothing to do with Buddhism, Hinayana, Mahayana. Instead, in a marriage, there's the third option. And that's when I look at the marriage, at the bride, first of all, just after they exchange the rings. And I say to her, from this day on, you're a married woman. You must not think of yourself. And she smiles and says, yes. And I look at the guy, the groom. I say the same thing to him. And sometimes Sri Lankans, all the same. I look at him and say, from this day on, you're a married man. You must not think of yourself either. And the man always hesitates. He does. He thinks about it. But he eventually comes round and says yes. The guys. Anyway, then still looking at the groom, the man said, yeah, from this day on, you mustn't think of yourself. And also from this day on, you're a married man. You must not think of her, your wife. And then I look at the girl and say, the same to her. You're a married woman now. You must not think of him from this day on, your husband. And they get really confused. And they wonder, who the heck is this stupid monk? And then I give them the punchline. This is not funny, this is actually very profound. From this day on, you mustn't think of yourself. From this day on, you must not think of your partner. From this day on, you must only think of us. relationship is about us. If you sacrifice for the other person, that's not a marriage. If you're just thinking of yourself, that's not a marriage, that's selfishness. The trick of a marriage is us. We don't think about me, I don't think about you, I only think about us. That's the trick of a marriage. That's the trick about anything. The Sangha is about us. About the BS3, it's not about me, it's not about Jack, it's about us. And when you know it's all about us, then if there's any problem, whose problem is it? Our problem, yeah. It's not your husband's problem. It's not her problem. Oh God, if Ajahn Bhavi only knew what it was like. It's not your own problem, it's our problem. You fix it up together. So, the budget, whose problem is it? Yeah, it's our problem. You guys voted these people in. So you should have same compassion for yourself as others, but even that doesn't really work. Have compassion for us. Ajahn Brahm, can you explain what is the best way to transfer merits to your loved one? The best way is to have merits first. And sometimes people transfer merits, they haven't got any. They come to the BSV or NBM, they don't give any donations, they eat all the food, they leave a mess, they never clean up afterwards, they never keep any precepts except, you know, for 1 hour. You know the 13 precepts which they keep in Sri Lanka these days? You've heard of 13 precepts? It's on Poya days. You haven't heard the 13 precepts on Poya days. They keep 8 precepts in the morning and 5 in the afternoon. That's called the 13 precepts. That's cheating. The 8 precepts, the biggest one of the 8 precepts is not eating in the afternoon. So they only keep that in the morning. And in the afternoon they go back to 5. That's called the 13 precepts. I don't forget about the Sri Lankans. The Thais are just as bad. Honest. Because when I went back to Thailand some years ago, and I was giving the 5 precepts, and I saw one person with a finger down, like this. And I'd never seen that before. I said, what's that? He said, oh, I'm only keeping 4 precepts today. They still chanted the whole 5, but one finger down went, and then of course you started looking. Sure enough, you saw someone with 2 fingers down. And I honestly, I saw one person, all the fingers down. They do all the chanting, Parnati Pada, Adina Dada, the whole chant, but all the fingers done, that meant no precepts. Crazy sort of people think that. So before you transfer merits, make merits first of all. That's the best way. And then it's going to be transferred automatically. You know, if your grandma up in heaven or wherever she was, you know, realized what you were doing, she'd be so happy. You know, my little daughter, she hasn't forgot the tradition, and she's been keeping her precepts on Poya days. My son, really good man, I'm so proud of him. You know, he doesn't drink alcohol. He just looks after the temples. You know, he's generous to them. They'd be so proud of you. That is a way to transfer merits. I heard reminiscing over good karma is good, and vice versa is true. But sometimes the guilt over past bad karma can be overwhelming, and you keep thinking about it over and over and over and over. Please help on how to manage this to stop accumulating more bad karma over reminiscing. First of all, just don't do bad karma in the first place. What do you do bad karma for? So don't do bad karma in the first place. And if you do bad karma, acknowledge it and tell someone about it. You can tell me or tell the venerable here all the bad karma you've done. And we'll put it in the newsletter. And and everybody will read it then. People love those sorts of stories. And so your newsletter will be, people actually read it for a change. It'd be very thick too. No. Just tell someone you trust, because it's really important to actually to bring it up to somebody, acknowledge it. And then once you've brought it up to someone, that, first of all, you realize it's not as bad as you thought it was. If you keep it to yourself, it always gets amplified. You take it to someone else and say, oh yeah, okay, I did that when I was young, I was stupid, I did a bad thing. So first of all, tell it to somebody else. And then give yourself forgiveness. Everybody makes mistakes. And then learn from it, which is the most important. Yeah, you've done a bad karma. Learn from it. Why did you do that? Don't put yourself in a position where you have to do that again. You know, you cheat in a business. Or, you know, you cheat on your wife or your husband. Now, don't put yourself in that position. If you find yourself getting hot for another person outside of marriage, you know, just move away. Tell someone, warn yourself, warn others, so that you know, you're never alone with that person. You never get caught up in it. Change your email number, telephone number, so those people can't call you. There's so much you can do to protect yourself, but you need the help of somebody else. So acknowledge, forgive, and learn not to do the same mistake again. There's nothing wrong with making mistakes. The only thing is we should learn from our mistakes. I just remembered another mistake I made, which I put in Opening the Door of Your Heart number one, or the first volume. I think Ajahn Jacaro had just left, and I was the monk for about 2 or 3 years, the abbot for 2 or 3 years afterwards. And I was, you know, trying to do my best to look after this place. We weren't all that well off at the time. And I was walking in the grounds of the monastery, Bodhinyana Monastery, and I saw a hammer, which had been left out in the grass, was getting rusty. Rusty! And I thought, this is not good enough, because as monks, you know, we depend upon charity. Somebody had offered the hammer to the Sangha, and some selfish, inconsiderate monk had left it out there to get rusty. And I know that many people are actually really poor, and that was, you know, quite a sacrifice for them to get $20 or something to get a hammer. They may be even on a pension. And they offered it to the Sangha, and the Sangha wasn't looking after it. That was not good enough. So that evening I called a meeting for all the monks, and I really gave it to them. So, you're monks. In our tradition we have to look after everything. We can't waste it. If someone even gives us a bar of chocolate, if we don't eat it ourselves, we give it away. We don't throw it away in the bin and waste it as if, you know, it's not respecting the charity. And you have to look after these things. And don't leave things lying around as if they were useless or worthless. Yes, I know you didn't buy it, but somebody did and gave it to us, and that's not good enough. You know, you may have seen that in some temples, they waste things. And you know how hard it is to do charity. It's not easy. You've got other commitments and bills to pay. So I really let the monks have it. And that evening, after I finished, I was just waiting for one monk to put their hand up and say it was me. I wouldn't have hit them or anything, but you know, at least I thought they would confess. And the most disappointing thing was no one would confess. And I thought, I lost my faith in the monks. I thought, this is terrible. I said, I was so disappointed as I walked out of the hall. Why didn't somebody say and confess? And then as I walked out of the hall, it hit me why they hadn't confessed. Because I remember who had left that hammer out. It had totally slipped my mind until after the long talk. I remember when I did it, I needed to come back and pick it up in a few minutes later. It was me. And I just blasted all the monks. Say, you can't leave the hammer out, you mustn't do this, it's bad, it's medical charity. So I turned around, went and hooked, and monks, could you please sit down for a moment? It was me. It was really embarrassing. But you know, at least I had the guts to admit it. Sometimes these things, they just slip your mind. Just, I don't know how I could for hours forget that I was the one who left it out there. Really embarrassing, but these things happen. So we all make mistakes, so we laugh at it, learn about it. We're human beings. So there we go. So, always remember the good stuff. And you do make mistakes. Acknowledge it, forgive it. Yeah, I do reminisce about that mistake. I tell everybody about it. We laugh together. That's the best way. All right, Jabob, how can I deal with disappointment over broken promises? Even though I don't want to be given promises and try and live without expectations, people sometimes give promises. Don't believe the promises when they give them. They're all tentative. You know, maybe the future's uncertain. No one can keep promises. That's when people actually ask me, are you coming here again next year? I can't promise. But all I'll say is if the conditions are right, I'll be back. Or I'll think about it. I remember my first talk. Because sometimes we make promises and for the best will in the world we can't keep them. Situations change. So always be careful with making promises. And in fact, I was taught this by Ajahn Chah, that if you do make a promise, you have to really try hard to keep it. Now really give it a lot of effort. So you know, if I'm not on time, I really try hard to be on time for appointments. And if I'm not on time, I'll usually ring up somebody and say, look, I'm terribly sorry, the plane was delayed, something happened, somebody died or something, and then, you know, at least have the respect not to leave somebody waiting or wondering where you are. So you try and keep your promises, but the best way to keep the promises is don't make too many. And, you know, if you do make a promise, make sure it's something you can keep. Sometimes I'm in a relationship where I'm giving a lot, putting in a lot of effort and love and not receiving much back. How can I work through feelings that I deserve more? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Because you do deserve more. Remember in that relationship, tell whoever you're having a relationship with, look, it's about us. It's not about me, not about you. And I'm not going to give to you, partner. I'm going to give to us. And that changes the whole dynamics of a relationship. So you don't give to your partner, you give to the relationship. Having to lose someone you love and having to live with the ones you don't love. This is a great one. He's both sad. How could you give me an answer to be calm, kind and peaceful in a situation like this? The greatest act of love is to let someone go. If you really love somebody, you're not sad when they go. You let them go. Darling, go with my blessing. Oh, you know, I've told these stories before, but this was just really moving for me. And I remember this, Jenny and Steve. And just maybe 25 years ago now. And Jenny still comes to the temple. And she's got her little thing of sailing on the Luin. One of these big boats goes up and down. These old three-master ships, you know, just the replicas sailing up and down the west coast of Australia. But she married this American guy, Steve, and they had the white water rafting business. These couple having the time of their lives, making money out of going to some of the most beautiful parts of the world and taking people on white water rafting. Just, you know, they were just such a lucky couple having a wonderful life until he got cancer. He's only in his late 30s. And of course, you know, I came along to do some counseling, looking at them and teaching them, and he was getting worse and worse, and then he came to the end of his life and something was happening. He wasn't dying. And I went to see them once, and he should have been dead a couple of days ago. And then, you know, he was suffering. It's just, you know, when people have cancer far gone, they're just so thin and so weak. And then I got a bit of an insight. You know, I turned to Jenny and said, Jenny, have you given Steve permission to die yet? And it hit the nail on the head. She never answered me. She just jumped up on the bed and held the love of her life in her hands, very gently, because he was so thin. And they looked in each other's eyes and he said, Steve, it's okay to die. I give you permission to die. You can die. I'll always love you enough to let you go. And it's a beautiful moment for me to witness. And that night he died. That's all he needed, permission from the person he loved so much that he just could not hurt her. That's why he was keeping her alive. He didn't want to hurt the person he loved the most in the whole world. And when she said, "It's okay, you can die," then he felt permission, he was free. And a lot of people have done that since I told that story to people. And this lady in Malaysia, she wrote a book about it, saying to us, she'd been practicing that, and so often as a counsellor, you know, someone was, they should have been dead, but they were hanging on. And they weren't going to survive, it's just more pain, more suffering. And I asked, "Family, have you given permission for your mum to die yet?" And they get it, and they go and do that. And a couple of hours later, she's dead. So that's an act of love, to let somebody go. Give them permission to die. So have you given me permission to die yet? Oh, you don't love me. So that's losing someone you love. That's a wonderful experience. You don't lose them. You've loved them. You've gained them. Is that a loss? Having known such a person and having loved them and shared their love together and these great memories, that's a gain. That's not a loss. And how do you... how do you having to live with the ones you don't love? Look, come on, get in there and start learning how to love them. You can love anybody. I have to live with all of you. I don't choose who comes to listen to my talks. People come to the monastery, I don't know who they come, they just come in. I have to love everybody. So you can learn to love anybody. It's really wonderful when you get somebody who's really difficult and you learn how to love them. Why not? You say to them, "The door of my heart is open to you, no matter who you are. You don't have to change. I'll accept you as you are." That's love. You can do that to anybody. And of course, if you start loving them, they change. We have a wonderful time together. Can you please explain the concept of time? I did something about that, about beginnings and ends last night, but I won't go through that one. But time is always when we measure things. Time is the distance from the past to the future, or the past to the present, or the present to the future. And imagine you're meditating, and there's no more past, no more future. No more idea of past, no more idea of future. And then time disappears. You're in the timeless present moment. And look at this time business. How do you feel right now in this moment? Is that any different to when we first came here this morning? It's the same, isn't it? And this person I've known for over 60 years, I look at myself now, just inside, it's no different, this experience of me, when you were a young boy, when you were a student, when you were a young monk. The feeling is timeless. If you really get into meditation, time disappears. It has no meaning anymore. You're in the present moment, the only place which ever exists, now. And sometimes people say to me, "Ajahn Brahm, why do you travel around so much?" I don't travel. I don't move. I just sit down in the plane. The plane moves, I don't. I sit down in a car and you arrive at Monash, Clayton campus. I don't move. So I'm always right here. You guys come, you guys go, but I'm always here. Tomorrow, I'll be here in Perth. You won't be here, I didn't move. There's a different way of looking at things, and it's wonderful when you can play around like that. And so time has no meaning when you stop measuring it in the present moment. "Dear Ajahn Brahm, why do my eyes start tearing when I am in meditation and sometimes feel panicky? Sometimes the reason why you feel teary is because you've been drinking too much water. When it gets up to here, it's got to overflow." VS is physics. Okay. Sometimes there's many reasons for crying. Sometimes there's emotional blockages when you come to do some meditation to get released. There was this guy over in Perth. He came on one of my retreats. And he's about in his mid-40s, late-40s. And during one meditation, he started crying. And he came and said, "What's going on?" "Ajahn Brahm, I started crying." And then my first question was to him, he said, "When was the last time you cried before this?" And he was silent. And he said, "About 40 years ago, when I was about 8 or 9, I started crying. And my dad said, 'Australian boys don't cry.' And I haven't cried since." And I told him, "You, sir, have got a lot of crying to catch up with." And he did that. Because he was letting go, relaxing, he felt safe in this type of meditation. He cried and cried and cried just for the next 6 days. And after that 6 days, I said, "How are you feeling?" "It's terrific. I feel so free and so relaxed, emotionally healed." And he'd been one of these Australian guys when you were suppressing your emotions. You weren't allowed to cry. Guys, sweaty Australian guys from the bush, they don't cry. So he did that, and it's wonderful that he did. A great release of a lot of sadness, a lot of disappointment, just needed to come out, that's all. So that's one reason. Some reason is because you just got so much happiness. Some reason is because of one of my bad jokes. Oh, that really makes me cry. But, you know, if it happens, a lot of time it's joy. So let it come. It's one of the forms of pity, the things which come in meditation. Tears. So let it happen. How are we going? 3:30. Oh, dude.
It's 3:30 now.
You've got people are stretching, got bad backs. One more question, then we'll have a break. What are your thoughts on the secret and the law of attraction? Can one negative thought manifest itself? Can one negative thought manifest itself? The secret is no longer a secret. People have sussed that out a long time ago. You write a crazy book and you make a lot of money. That's the secret. The secret is there's so many gullible people in this world willing to part their money buying stupid books like this, but you get them to make a donation for Newbie Buddhist Monastery and they don't. So, it's rubbish that. The secret of it, I read one little extract from it. They say, just visualize the check. Visualize the $5,000 check in your mailbox. Just visualize it. Now believe in it. Don't doubt it. And when you go home this evening, there'll be a $5,000 check. The law of attraction. Because what you think about, you attract that. $5,000. Imagine it. $5,000. That's rubbish. You might get a bill for $5,000, but not a check. But people actually believe that. You know, the gullibility, just like those other scams, you know, you get these people, you know, who want to marry you from, you know, from Nigeria or somewhere. And there's so many people, they send money. "I'll just send some money over for my ticket and I'll come and marry you." Just the beliefs of people, the gullibility of people. So please, you know, don't be so gullible. Secret. It's not a secret, it's the scam, yes. Should rename it, the scam, by Robert Burns. Okay, so that's enough now. So, now the law of attraction, just visualize the toilet. Visualize it and you'll soon be attracted there. So it's coming, it's gonna happen, I guarantee it. So off you go, toilet break, come back in 1/4 an hour, do some more meditation.